Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Jennifer Lindsay, and I am hosting today's session of Blog Talk Radio, Break Through the Noise. Every episode, we chat with influencers who we feel are making a significant difference in the influence space. So that can be journalists, it can be social media folks, can be lots of others. And with me today is Michael Singer, who I hope can hear us.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm just trying to find where the influencers are. I think we're both looking for them at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really funny. Michael and I have known each other and swung in the same circles for years now. And I got to say, and I said this in my blog post, he is one of the people that you look forward to crossing paths with again. And so even though, you know, they call going into PR once you've been a journalist the dark side, I like to think that I'm on, you know, good ground with Michael because, you know, I'm looking out for people connecting with one another through social media. So,
well, depending on how well the publishing industry goes, we may all be turning to the dark side pretty soon, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's. You know, kind of, you know, an interesting segue into one of the things that one of the questions. So I solicited questions from Twitter. So there's a mixture of questions from Twitter and a mixture of questions from myself and other people at Eastwick Communications. And that is sort of one of the things that I want to ask you about, which is in this competitive landscape of journalism. You know, it's kind of a war zone almost, it feels like, at least on the outside looking in. How is Information Week, or does Information Week have to sell the value of itself as a publication and, you know, an important influencer in the space? How does it position itself, or what's its differentiating factor, do you feel like, when you're going out and interviewing people or seeking interviews?
It's an awesome question, and I will answer it from a standpoint that let's take a look at the overall industry first, and then we'll get specific on Information Week. I mean, one doesn't have to look too far to find how beaten and bruised the publishing industry is. In San Francisco, obviously, we have the San Francisco Chronicle, whose parent company, Hearst Media, was considering a sale of their only publication out here. Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which is also owned by Hearst, shut down its print operations. It's now a solely online publication, and hundreds of people have somewhere else to go looking for a job. And you don't have to go, you know, this goes over newspapers and magazines. I mean, I can't tell you the number of colleagues I've met in the last, you know, 2 years who have told me, I don't know where to turn, because their valuable services, you know, their long range, very deep kind of intellect is unfortunately being outsourced by social media, by sort of the corporations themselves coming up with new innovative ways of getting their own message out and sort of bypassing the gaze of some sort of a third-party system like publishing or, you know, journalism. So I think from an overall broad standpoint, it's really a challenge for people who are in our publishing industry to say, hey, we're still important, you know, and or relevant, when a lot of the consumer vision of what's going on here is not necessarily predicated by, you know, knowing that you've got the New York Times in your back pocket, or, you know, that you know you're going to get a magazine at the stand on your way in the airport. So that's kind of like, it's not necessarily doom and gloom, but it, for our industry, it does present a lot of challenges. So to talk more specifically about Information Week, which is a publication both in print and online, and in a lot of different ways too. I mean, we also the parent company is a TechWeb, which is also owned by UBM, which is United Business Media, and our group has kind of looked at the problem from lots of different facets. Fortunately, and I'm very, very happy to say this, the print magazine is doing very well. We've actually increased pages. We've solidified a lot of advertisers. And so we continue to put out a very high-quality product. So, you know, those people who want to, you know, pick up a copy, they're more than welcome to, and they'll find it's a mile deep and a mile wide. I mean, that's really sort of how we differentiate ourselves from a lot of the other competition who talk about IT technology, internet systems, and for any C-level executive who's out there, or system admin, or IT decision maker, I think Information Week is probably the, if not one of the places that they turn first.
So you're really saying basically that you feel like Information Week is reaching specifically the C-level and decision maker range.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we kind of pride ourselves on having a lot of the top-level executives either, you know, calling us up and saying we want to talk to you guys first, or we also have them on an advisory board. I mean, we have several high-level executives who are advising us on what they like to see, and we take that into consideration when we look at our strategies. News is news, so you can't really get around that. But what we bring to the table is, like I said, a mile deep and a mile wide.
Speak to your experience, too, not to interrupt, but, you know, certainly you have incredibly deep knowledge, and I am, you know, regrettably, you know, one of those people that has called Michael on occasion and said, how does this actually work?
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell me in plain terms how this works. So I think clearly, you know, from my perspective, yes, you know, you are definitely able to go deep on the topics that you have, and the reporters that I've met at conferences that work with you are the same way. They can really talk with a level of depth that,
right,
you know, is not often seen.
We celebrate that once a year by identifying the top 500 companies and really sort of pinpointing those individuals within the C-level, CIO, CTOs, who are bringing new and different ways of looking at the problems. Because ultimately, you know, I was taught this very early on, and I kind of preach to the choir here, but my job is to inform and entertain. Because if I'm saying something important, but if I'm not being entertaining at the same fell swoop, you're probably going to get bored of me real quick. So
I can vouch for your entertainment value, so that's very good.
But the information is also important. So anyway, in terms of, you know, what do people want? They want to get information that is relevant to them, that helps solve their problems. And also, they want to get a perspective on things that they may not get from other sources. So, for example, let's say I'm looking at this whole notion of consolidating resources, or we've just gone through an acquisition, or we're considering an acquisition of a small asset or a company. Smartphones, for example. I mean, this is a huge industry now. A lot of players are you know, really drawing very hard and fast rules, but the majority of devices out there are personal items and not necessarily corporate issued, you know. So you've got a range of devices from BlackBerries to iPhones to Nokia devices to Samsung devices. Not all of them run on the same platforms. Not all of them have the same security measures. So, I mean, if you're a corporation trying to figure out how to herd all these cats together, then you've got to get, you know, up-to-date information on, you know, what's a good strategy, and where you can find that is within our pages, not only, you know, in the magazine, but also online. And then talking to the broader way of how we get the information out, TechWeb has been really instrumental in fostering a lot of these live events, and we're also doing webinars. Mm-hmm. And also, we're publishing and we're coordinating publishing of white papers and also analytics and reports. So let's talk first about the live events. You've got co-sponsored events that we put together, like Web 2.0. Mm-hmm. That's coming up at the end of this month, as a matter of fact, the 31st.
Mm-hmm.
We also put together items like the Black Hat Security Conference. So this mm-hmm. is a chance for, you know, white hat guys and black hat guys to kind of get together and trade secrets, for that matter. Also Interop, which is one of our marquee items.
Mm-hmm.
And this has really been growing by leaps and bounds every year. We do it twice a year, as we do with the Web 2.0 show.
Mm-hmm.
Because we found that, you know, there's people on both coasts. So there's usually one in New York and one in Las Vegas of both of these shows. Every year, and we've noticed a huge draw of interest. So you've got the live events. Now we're looking at webinars. We are getting our knowledgeable editors and people like that to really kind of speak online. So you get it on demand. You can get it 15 minutes before you're going into a briefing, and you can sound like the intelligent person around at the table at your meeting, for that matter, and say, "Oh yes, of course. Well, I have the up to date information about this particular topic, as they say on blah blah blah." And then, of course, our reports and analytics are very thoughtful, very focused ways of getting those types of things. So, from our perspective, from the publishing perspective, we can't just rely on one medium anymore. We never could. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, thankfully, I think we've covered all as many bases as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, I know you've been, as an organization, very involved in events, and I obviously, you know, the economy is affecting how many events people are going to, at least in my circle. So,
mm-hmm.
for example, a lot of people didn't go to Ecom. They didn't, you know, that I knew anyway. And some of the other smaller conferences in the area earlier in the year, and they kind of saved it up to go to South by Southwest Interactive.
Yes.
Not all of us could go to that either. In fact, I spoke last week at this time with Michael Brito from Intel, and we were both saying how we wished we were doing the interview from South by Southwest. So while South by Southwest may not be an event you're putting on, how are you serving the folks at your events that can't make the event in person, or are you creating maybe a segment of events that are virtual?
Right, and this talks to the webinars that we put together, and also some virtual events. We reproduced a virtual trade show just last year. As a matter of fact, I think there is one in the works now, and that they are ways for you to go into this almost like Second Life community, and you can connect with just, you know, the vendors themselves directly. It's not necessarily the same thing. As a matter of fact, I'm almost seeing a resurgence in the need to be in a face-to-face conversation.
Yeah, I agree.
Because we are a community of people who are addicted to the internet, and that's all well and good. But sometimes you actually need to see how the other person reacts when you say, "I've got a great idea." You want to see the eyebrows raise and you go, and the smile come onto the face. You don't want to just, you know, make that presentation and have blank stares.
I mean, I know one of the frustrations overall has been, all of us understand budget cuts, but with South by Southwest, for example, it was the first big social, you know, in terms of South by Southwest Interactive, and I don't mean to confuse that with the music conference or the music festival, but I think a lot of people expressed to me and shared concern that bosses were saying, "Oh, it's an excuse to go to a party," when it was really such a need to be able to, you know, just get in the same room with the people that you're talking to virtually all the time,
mm-hmm.
and actually have some human interaction that comes out and is useful in a variety of ways, from business development to just a check on your own skill levels, because if you're not obviously in this environment investing constantly in making sure you know the latest and greatest information, you can't advise clients at a high level with any sense of authority. So you have to find other ways to do that, and that can be time-consuming. So
yeah, and when you're talking about time-consuming too, I mean, there are regional differences, yes, but I mean, if, for example, you were advising a client on a new product strategy and you wanted to hit a specific demographic, you know, you could do lots and lots of polls, but in a virtual world, that kind of stuff is usually ignored. It's almost to the benefit of a live event to have people, you know, they, as they say, cheeks and seats, and ask them just a broad question over any sort of breakout session or main keynote, and to say, hey, how many of you are doing X, or, you know, what kind of percentage are we looking at that is participating in, you know, like social media or video or virtualization or anything like that. And it just the physical seeing of the arms raised gives you almost an instantaneous feedback that you probably couldn't have gotten anywhere else. Because there's that,
yeah,
there's that peer pressure at a live event to, you know, raise your torch, or you know, flicker your cell phone so that you want encore, or, you know, throw them to the wolves kind of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, this talking about kind of virtual and how the publishing industry is changing. One thing we haven't really talked about, which was another contributed question, is how your organization, and you can speak broadly about the publishing industry if you like, or specifically at Information Week, dealing with user-generated content. We're seeing companies like, is it TechNet, I believe, that has a blogging network. We know Fast Company has a blog network.
Huffington Post has a blog network. You know, they.
It's a
place for user-generated content. You know, I was thinking about this before the call, and I thought to myself, you know, gee, if all the newspapers in the world disappeared today, and all of the major organizations that we would count on for news disappeared overnight, where would people get their information? Now, that's probably it's a travesty unto itself, but you would think to yourself, okay, I would probably rely on a social network of some sort, or some sort of a trusted source for this kind of information. So I might turn to my Facebook page and see what other people might be talking about that day. Or I might have to turn to some sort of a Twitter feed that I've subscribed to, you know, to get the latest information from a trusted source. But the main thing is that you've got to be able to have that real sort of connection and appreciation for what that information is and where it's coming from. So I think that, you know, even though the medium is changing, the integrity of the message definitely needs to be concise and also consistent. So for what we're trying to do as far as, you know, making sure that our message is on point, is to be able to, you know, get that feedback from people. Now, user-generated content is all well and good, and there are naysayers who say, yeah, it's about the same amount of accuracy as about a million monkeys with a million typewriters. But there can be some good feedback in that. And so we do have a couple of assets that we have turned to sort of foster that. One of them is just been awarded a MIN award, and that's in Internet Evolution. And IE is a really fun place to see. We've collected a lot of bright minds. And they're not employed by us, but we ask them to contribute, you know, their think pieces. And so you've get.
So who are the types of people that are involved, the bright minds?
Those bright minds are either executives from certain companies, or they might be members of the blogosphere who have good opinions about certain things. You know, so it's a mix of both professional and non-professional. People who are looking at this situation, also people from industry organizations who might contribute to this. So anyway, they'll put up their posts, and then that's sort of like a pseudo user-generated content. But then the conversations that we allow to have happen and naturally form within the comment section, that kind of back and forth, can lead to further investigation of, you know, sort of these best practices, or they'll turn around and they'll say, you know, oh yeah, that's a great idea, that cloud thing, you know, but sounds kind of ambiguous to me. I don't know if I want to invest, you know, six figures on, you know, ripping and replacing, and or, you know, just writing a check to IBM or, you know, Google for that matter. You know, people are very, very nervous about that kind of an approach. So I think, you know, there is a place for it, for this consumer-generated content, but I don't know. I mean, I'm old school. I don't know.
I think there's two things. One is, you know, I think about the advice I give to my clients about Business Week Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Because clearly Business Week has made a big commitment in both their print editions at different times as well as online to user-generated content. There's that subset of Business Week where they've partnered with Capital IQ that's publishing the initial data on most public companies on LinkedIn. So there's a social media component as well. So they seem to have something interesting going as well. It sounds like I'm definitely going to check out this internet evolution space and
mm-hmm.
see, you know, if there's something there for our clients. But when I think about some of some of the most interesting, and I actually just contributed to an article someone's writing on interesting Twitterers that you have in your feed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about yours a lot because you you talked earlier about kind of having a sense of, you know, you're topical, but you have a sense of humor about things. And you are a prolific user of Twitter. And I'm just wondering if any of the comments you get back, which is a form, I guess, of user-generated content, make it into anything that gets published or that you take into account in the editorial process?
Let's preface it by saying, for those of you listening right now, the address is twitter.com/Michael Singer.
Which is all also one, a link from our all, page. So.
There's a link from the page, and it's all one word. So, naturally I expect my Twitter-holic numbers to just skyrocket by the end of this. You know, here's my Twitter strategy, and this is actually a modification of my colleague. His name's Mitch Wagner. Mitch is one of our editors at large who is in charge of our social media strategy. And so he and I had a good conversation about Twitter once, and he says, you know, you got to make it so that people don't think that you're just hooking for links. And all you ever provide are, you know, links back to your own content. I mean, that people will get very savvy to that very quickly. So you kind of do have to mix it up. So what I've done is I've taken a 90-10 approach, but within that, so 90% being the professional submissions, you know, here's what I'm thinking, here's what we're doing. This is all related to, you know, either the company or to the news that we're publishing. And then the other 10% would be, you know, just things that are either exciting to me or bothering me, you know, stupid dog videos or great causes. But I do make it all a conversation so that it's not just a regurgitation of a headline. I try to flip it around and ask questions while I'm doing this. For example, one of the biggest news items to come out this week was suggestion, and this is unsubstantiated rumors at this point, but IBM potentially purchasing Sun Microsystems in excess of, you know, $6.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Big story. If it ever does happen, it'll probably be one of the biggest acquisitions in the IT industry. It'll
mm-hmm.
affect millions
mm-hmm.
of people. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, great. So you definitely have to put out the news. Hey, this is what we're hearing in the industry. Can anybody, you know, sort of follow up on this or hear anything differently? But then you start thinking about what's the major impact of this, and you have to think to yourself, gee, I wonder what this means for, you know, the people that built Sun. You know, those are very strong personalities, and one of the founders, his name is Scott McNeely. Scott was
no relation.
You know, none
whatsoever.
People
know my maiden name.
None whatsoever. But, I mean, he was one of those guys when Hewlett-Packard acquired Compaq, referred to it as two garbage trucks colliding. And so now that his, you know, baby, because he's still the chairman, now that his baby is being, you know, an acquisition target by his most hated enemy, IBM, you know, what is, I'm wondering what he's thinking. And so I even Twittered that. I said, you know, gee, I wonder what Scott's thinking now that, you know, Sun could be scooped up by IBM. And then I, you know, followed it by, it's probably something to the effect of, you know, in curse word symbols, you know, to the rest of the message. And I got a tweet back from a friend of mine who, you know, works in the industry, and he says that it was probably the funniest thing I'd read all day. But
yeah,
you know,
I mean, I think I saw that and laughed out loud.
You don't want to go for just chuckles, but you do want to make people think. So one of the first things I actually tweeted about was the whole notion of this microblog, and I said, do people want to hear more about microblogging? Yes or no? And actually, I got some responses back, direct responses and such, saying, hey, yeah, we do want to hear more about how to use it, or what's it for, or why do we think this is a good thing, because the people who've put it together have been under a lot of pressure, number one, to scale, you know, so you get your fail whale every once in a while, but not only that, but also to monetize, and they're still of the opinion that they may not want to, you know, they may even say, this needs to become sort of like an organization as opposed to a corporation, where it's keeps its integrity, you know, because, you know, everybody from Google to Microsoft to, you know, Joe on the street has got his you know, pocketbook out saying, you know, hey, Twitter, I'd love to buy you, and then we could really make some money. But they've been really slow and methodic, and I think guys like Biz are just more pragmatic about the approach to it. They didn't really their focus is to, you know, help people communicate better, faster, and less out of control. So as far as Twitter strategies go, we kind of looked at that and said, this is a perfect venue for us. We were actually probably one of the first companies to do broad based, you know, distribution of our content. So we have, you know, pretty much all of our properties will have some sort of a Twitter role that you can follow. Each of the individual contributors is asked to at least, you know, look at it and use it in certain ways. So that's also nice about the company itself, is that it's very open to allowing the employees to make their own decisions and to really have those conversations with the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what we look at. It's been very positive. You know, every once in a while you get some trolls who want to sell you some stuff, but for the most part, it really does work as a good communications tool. And we're seeing a lot of uptick in the marketing and public relations venues, saying, you know, they use it almost like a monitor of who's saying what about their clients.
Use it that way, and we also use it as we try to provide sort of an information stream about our clients, so that we're not just trying to, you know, so there's a push-pull dynamic. So we're contributing as well as, we think, as well as, you know, providing, you know, context for our clients about what's being said out there on the blogosphere.
And that's what you want. You want a push-pull. You want what people have been calling the participation age. You know, if you if you listen to Clay Shirky for any length of time, or if you...
Oh, I love him.
Or if you listen to even, you know, John Battelle, these guys will say, you know, it's not necessarily about sitting around and just, you know, soaking in all this information. It's also about giving your voice about it, too. And so... we kind of take a look at that as an opportunity as well. You know, how are people responding to certain trends or even our own content? You know, so we incorporate that within, you know, all of our properties and that kind of thing. So we have a chance for people to, you know, let us know what they're thinking either via Twitter or Reddit or Slashdot or, you know, even comments in the forum areas. But also, you know, you take a look at how they're responding to these things, and they say, yeah, this is a great story, but boy, it could have been, you know, gangbusters if it just had this one element. Or if you talk to my client, it would be even better. That's usually what happens. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're at the halfway point. I have a whole bunch more questions for you, but I just want to welcome any new listeners to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Neely, or actually Jennifer Lindsay. Neely's my maiden name. Going backwards in time, I'm the Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications. And every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Today we're speaking with, I'm happy to say, my friend as well as a great journalist. He's the West Coast editor for Information Week, Michael Singer.
I'm still looking for who the influencer is that you're talking to. I have no idea.
we'll figure it out by the end. We'll see what's happening on Twitter.
But what's funny, Jennifer, is that, you know, I didn't get into this business because I thought it was going to be, you know, sexy. I thought I was getting into the business because it just really hooked me. And I started off before you and I met. I was looking at television as a venue. And what was bothering me about the broadcast industry was that it was definitely about if it bleeds, it leads. And being a family man, a young family man at the time, it just became overwhelming with as much gore and negative news that was going on. And fortunately, you know, I started to migrate towards the more neutral kinds of information, like what we're seeing now with, you know, within the tech industry. I mean, I got on as the thing was crashing down. And so by all means, I probably should have run the other way. And I'm glad I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a great ride. And I even think that the current slump that we're in has got, you know, I'm telling people, guess what? This is your golden opportunity now to go to your garage and create the next big, you know, whatever you want to, you know, put it in there. Go create another Google. Go create another Facebook. Go create another Twitter. And you'll see how many of these small companies, the VC funding will come back. And I think that people are going to be really excited. You know, that's...
And we've talked to VCs who say they're still looking for something really innovative to pitch. So whether that's true or not and bears out, you know, publicly, we'll see. But it's, you know, something I've heard going around more than one time.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I actually gave a chat with some a presentation to some PR people who, with another agency who shall remain nameless. But basically, I stood in front of these guys and I said, you know what, outside of, you know, national security, you guys now have the hardest job in the entire industry. And I'm talking about, you know, public relations marketing, because it used to be just those trusted sources that you went to. You went to Business Week, you went to, you know, CNET, you went to, if you wanted front page news, you went to the Times or the Journal or something along those lines with your clients. And that's an easy get. I mean, that's a no-brainer. Those salad days are gone for you guys now, and because you've got not only a fractured publishing industry who's, you know, competing against itself and actually, you know, doing an end around and going to the vendors themselves, so they don't even use a lot of PR industry people for absolutely everything like they used to. But think about this. Now you've got user-generated content in the forms of Twitters and LinkedIn blasts or news feeds from other sources, blogs. You know, it's got to be mind-boggling from your profession's end. You know, how do you make sure that the good stuff gets to the right people? And so it's almost like when you have to deal with an old-time news industry or news outlet like Information Week, it's got to be refreshing. You pick up the phone, you actually talk to a human person, and he's not going to give you a ration of, you know, Michael Arrington ego to say, well, of course you have to give me an exclusive because I am who I am. Well, that's great, but you know, I don't need you. You know, you need us. And it's sort of like the symbiotic relationship at that point.
Yeah,
so
I was going to sort of ask you something related because I think it's kind of, you know, what it's interesting from the perspective of people that are interested in news and people that are interested in PR. And, you know, I've written blog posts. I'll never not consider myself a journalist. It is the hardest thing for me when I'm filling out the forms of what I do, you know, even if it's to try to get a free report on something to see if it's any, if it has any value. You know, I'll never not think of myself that way because that's, I'm just hardwired for it, you know. So I'm always looking for the fires at work, much to some of my coworkers' chagrin and maybe my own sanity. But I got to ask this because it just, I always wonder about this when you're not on the inside. So what I'm wondering is how many, you know, do reporters and editors get a lot of pitches these days from your perspective? And I ask this because, and this is only part of the time, I get the sense from my, you know, I went to Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and mm-hmm. I'm a member of a number of their listservs, so I get a real pulse for what's going on in the reporting community. And some of the reporters that are on those lists seem to be hunting for pitches. So I will, you know, post, hey, is anybody interested in this? More for our pro bono clients or people we're just trying to help out. A lot of our Eastwick Cares, which is our sort of give back, or it's actually called Eastwick Gives Back, so that makes more sense. So the, you know, the trying to drum up volunteers if they're in the area.
Mm.
But where are you with story ideas and how they correlate to what's published, specifically pitches?
That's a great question, and there are two schools of thought. First of all, the industry trade secret is that, well, actually the editors, even though if they're competing, we talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny because in preparation for this presentation that I was doing, not for this particular one, but for one I had done previously, I took a survey of some other editors from other publications, and I said, you know, what's your take on this particular agency as far as, you know, how nice are they, how easy are they to work with? And, you know, the feedback I was getting was it was really eye-opening. So we do talk to each other about agencies, and I think what's there's two schools of thought. The number first one is that if it's good, hot, good old-fashioned, you know, scoopy news, it doesn't matter what time of day you call me, you know, just call me. So they do want to be first in the minds of those agencies and of their clients. But let's say, for example, it's a slow news day, and or it's maybe a, you know, you're in between announcements with a client, and they're trying to drum up some interest or business within their industry. It can be difficult, you know. And I get some really crazy pitches. For example, I mean, I'm not going to name her name, but a good friend of mine pitched me on 9/11. She says, "Well, do you want to talk to this storage company?" I said, "Why would I talk to a storage company on 9/11? This is like the last one, not necessarily the first one."
Uh-huh.
But so like this past September, I said, why would I want to talk to a storage company about 9/11? She says, well, you can just sort of talk about the whole, the way that you use
security?
That as your, well, no, not security, as far as backup, you know, and tie it into the, you know, the tragedy of today. And I said,
what, like use it as a bomb shelter?
Well, no, I mean, because there's data recovery and data backup and disaster recovery was one of the client's hopes to sort of, you know, own the space on. And
I got
This PR person was trying to encourage me to write about their client as one of the leaders of this in a time when, you know, people's thoughts are on disasters. And I was like, oh. Did you hurt your rotator cuff? Because, man, you're reaching far on that one. I got to tell
you.
Yeah,
that's. And that, and, even if and, it worked,
and I
that
told her,
be...
I said, you know, this is kind of inappropriate. I really wouldn't even try to go there. Now, the more amusing ones are like this past St. Patrick's Day, for example. You know, we were getting pitches about, you know, oh, listen to our client, they're so green. Oh, man, that was bad. But that doesn't bother me as, no, I know. Pause for effect there on that one. But that doesn't bother me as much as the way that it gets communicated. Okay, let's say, for example, and you've probably had this happen before you mm-hmm. came to Eastwood, is that you've got somebody emails you about this great product from this no-name company,
mm-hmm.
and then they call you within 5 minutes. And then you say, well, you know, I'm kind of on deadline. Maybe you can, you know, just I'll take a look at the email. And they say, okay, no problem, sure, fine. And then within 10 more minutes, they send you another email asking if you've got the first email and that you left a message on their voice machine and that, you know, so it's like this natty kind of, you know, buzzing that happens all around your head and you're just trying to do your job.
And now I get that from recruiters who are that are usually trying to, you know, sell me. This great graphic designer was an example from today, and I'll not name the company that did it, but I have opted out in every way I know how, and I'm still getting, you know, the deluge, and I completely understand, you know, I mean, I was one of the first people to write, so when I worked at ABC, writing online-only exclusives,
mm-hmm.
and I always tell the folks at Eastwick that, you know, I did one story from a press release, and it was because I knew the person, I had worked with them in news, knew they had a very high level of integrity. There was a bit of activism to it, so people could do something actionable that would help, hopefully improve some lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I did an online-only exclusive for her,
mm-hmm.
and, which ended up getting picked up by the newsroom. So it ended up being successful. That's the only press release I ever looked at, which brings me to a question about social media press releases.
The PR industry started licking their chops when they figured out they could get direct messages to individual reporters and or blasts out, you know, on these things. And I think the jury's still out on it. I think that the old-fashioned methods are still better. Although,
so can I try out my theory on you?
Go for it.
So there was a Forrester study that came out, and I used this in a presentation to one of our clients on for a blogging, how to blog seminar. And so there was a Forrester study, and these I'm rounding the numbers, but it was, you know, people surveyed by Forrester, something like 14% said they believed in the accuracy and the validity and basically credibility of corporate sites and corporate blogs as an official news source. The same, and that's often quoted and looked at, but the
sure.
same source asked later when a disaster strikes, so some of this is information from after the near plane crashes we've had, so the US Airways one in particular,
okay.
and people being asked where they're going for news when a disaster strikes and if they're having a hardware failure, if, you know, they can't get their online backup to work or, you know, things that are related to both our industry, but anything that, you know, makes somebody react quickly. The first place they go, it said it's something like 90% of people trusted as their number one news source and went to first. The corporate website. So what I take from this is that I don't know how much, you know, and maybe this is a bold statement to make. I'm too new to PR to know if this is a bad thing to say, but I'm not sure I know what the value is of a wire service when I create or recommend a social media newsroom, which is basically a hall of record for press releases for a company, hopefully with interesting multimedia that bloggers, you guys, anyone can use as a more interactive toolkit that is thinking more as a story, thinking more in the speak of a reporter. How is it that the source of information in the press release doesn't become centered around the companies, because search is the first place you're going to go. And we all know that the various wire services index really well. But what I'm starting to see is my clients that even have just blogs, let's say, are indexing higher. So I actually, and if search continues to be the main place people are using, and the latest studies I've seen suggest that, you know, in the example of Yelp, if people are going to Yelp, they never type it in their address bar anymore. They just search for it. They just go, because it might have a subdomain listed that they really want to just get to. That's how they interact with basically the internet in general.
So if people
are looking for information, isn't it search that should drive it? I mean, doesn't, you know, so there's the distribution to various people. you know, yourself would, you know, you'd be one of the targets. But increasingly, it sounds like people, you know, on those slow news days, you're going to be looking for news. You're going to be looking for things that are interesting. And I would assume you're going to be looking to search engines to help you find your way.
Well, it's a bit of a broad thing, and I'll talk about two different aspects of it. The first is, you know, what's the value of a wire service? Well, as my parent company, who owns PR Newswire, I would definitely advocate for these types of wire services, only because if you know from personal experience, if you want to find out information about a particular product or service or type of thing, you know, unless you want to spend all day going to each and every of those beat sites that you are going to, you want somebody to be able to deliver that information to you in a more timely fashion. So you might subscribe.
Sure.
For example, I have I subscribe to not only PR Newswire but Business Wire and PR Web, and they send releases that I click off as being important to me first, and then I filter through that on the ones that I'm interested in, and then I don't trust the corporations to tell me what their news is. I mean, I don't think any reporter should. You know, consumers a little bit different, because then you're going to say, okay, well, if I go to Apple's site and they tell me all about the new iPod Nano, I'm going to have to trust that they're telling me the truth on this. I mean, we in the industry, we're quick to break it apart, look at it, and say, oh, wait a minute, well, there's this little proprietary chip in there. What's that all about? And then, you know, the blogosphere was helpful in bringing that out. We have a teardown service that we've purchased, as a matter of fact, the tech web people have purchased. So we were able to take a look at these things and say, oh, okay, now this is why you need to know about this, because it might be something down the line where it's a way for Apple to sort of get a corner on the market on those headphones. You can't plug in a normal headphone into the new Nano because it won't work that way. There's no there's no controls on the machine. All the controls are within the headphone.
The unit.
Right.
Oh, they're within the headphone.
So anyhow, you know, in terms of where people go to get their trusted sources, I also would probably say that, you know, if something were to happen, a plane in Hudson Bay, or, you know, an earthquake event here in California, knock on wood, the first place I'm turning to is either the radio or the television, you know. And that's kind of like a backwards thinking, but it's, you know, still the place where people go in an emergency. But if I wanted to, okay, like, if you've ever done a search for, like, some really unusual gadgetry, that can also be very daunting as well, because a lot of the companies are, especially the small ones, who are putting out, like, third-party types of, you know, things that you would see on Engadget or Gizmodo or something like that. If you go backwards and you try to find more information about that, sometimes they're kind of masked, because the companies are really targeted towards getting the product out and not necessarily marketing all around it.
Right.
So you almost have to, like, pick up the phone, and thankfully some of them still, you know, post their phone numbers, so you can actually call a live person and say, okay, kid.
Yeah, we definitely encourage that.
Oh yeah. So yeah, I think that search is still the current champ, but, and this is the second part of what I'm trying to say, is that you're going to find a new dynamic happening real soon, and it's actually kind of in the works with things that Google is putting together, and also other companies like Microsoft, and that is the old notion of push, in the sense that that, you know, you also don't really have a lot of time to go through an inbox. If you have more than, you know, say 20 things in your inbox, to get up to date on something that may have only been in within the spidering of a search. So there's going to be that relationship where people are going to say, all right, I trust this particular, you know, person or range of people, and they're going to push to me that information which I am deeming relevant and important to me, and it's going to go to the form factor and device that I am carrying on my person at that time that is going to give me the edge that I need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does that mean for the industry is that it's got to, you know, sort of do that retooling and rethinking. Like, for example, I mean, we've talked about Twitter and Facebook and also LinkedIn, but there's other ones that are out there. And a lot of corporations are putting together back again the whole dashboard idea. I told my CEO, I said, you know what, if the next person who comes up with a dashboard that sort of combines all my other social media networks and things like that, that I can, you know, tap into at any given time, that person is going to be the millionaire. And it doesn't even have to be, you know, continually upgraded, just whenever I want it to be upgraded, updated, I should say, in a sense that you want it to be, you know, timely to me now. Because you don't care about the rest of the world. You only care about what's important to you that's going to either get you through your day or get you through
your... So it's all about filtering.
It's all about me.
Yeah, well, filtering for you, for your brain, your needs.
It's all about me.
Speaking of you, Lita in our office asked me to ask you, what publications, websites, blogs do you read on a regular basis?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, it changes from day to day. In an editor's chair, is it a lot different from a beat reporter's chair? So a beat reporter is really limited to the size and scope of what they're supposed to be responsible for. Editors, we have to take a larger view picture. So it does vary depending on what the group think is focused on. In addition to our own blogs, and I would encourage people to investigate that, because that's also another user-generated thing. We actually do pay our bloggers, but the you know, they are also a good brain trust of people that will contribute their own independent thoughts on things.
Let's talk high level, because, I mean, people want to get inside your head. So I use
God, you don't want to get inside my head. It's a dark and dingy place.
Well, hopefully not too dark and dingy. We live in the
spider
town.
Webs and stuff. getting in the head of Michael Singer, I would say that.
Yeah.
What do I like to go to and view?
Publications, blogs, sites.
I think that, you know, the obvious one is the Google News. I think that I'd be a liar if I tell you anything different. And the primary reason is it is kind of like a console of news and information, and not just for our own industries, but also the bigger picture. So you know, I want to see how my Final Four team is doing. I want to see how the president is doing. I want to see how the economy is doing. But then, you know, I mean, it'll filter down fast to, you know, all the technology groups that I look at. You know, where else do I go? I have to pull up my browser now.
So are you using a reader? What reader do you use?
A web browzer?
I use Google Reader. So I was thinking of an RSS reader. Do you subscribe that way, or do you prefer to get email updates, or do you like to go to sites?
I do have like a Google alert. Okay, so the problem is that I have to pretend that I'm the average reader who doesn't subscribe to things or customize too much, because if I customize, say for example, if I use Google Reader or if I use iGoogle or if I'm using some other type of, you know, Windows Live kind of feed on that, I don't know if I'm getting the average person's experience. I'm getting my experience, but I'm not necessarily getting the average person's experience. So I do an unfiltered, you know, news search on Google and on Windows Live. You know, I'll still go to the front page of the New York Times just to kind of get a look and feel of what's going on there, not necessarily subscribing to them. You know, in terms of other kinds of tech, I actually have a YouTube subscription to AP.
Mm-hmm.
So they send little video clips, and so you know, that actually is good.
I know somebody who creates those clips.
Yeah, and
that I went to school with.
And that's what's good about that is that you get a chance to take a step back for, you know, in between, you know, projects or on your lunch hour, you go back and you say, gee, what's happening in the rest of the world and how might that be impacting things? And AP is, I can't say enough good things about them and Reuters. It's, you know, if those two other organizations go away, we're all doomed.
I know. That's true. I mean, you have to have, you know, a certain level of integrity and standards in what's published. So it's good for people to have those, you know, kind of those names, you know, along with, you know, the New York Times that's still trying to innovate and, you know, the fast companies, the Wireds of the world that make information technology fun as much as they can.
Yeah.
So I think they tap into things that are interesting.
And video is good, too, as a background noise, you know, if you don't have the television on. It's you know, clicking through a couple of videos as a what do they call it? But I mean, just, you know, having it run in the background so you can like listen to things as they're happening. That's always a good thing. But,
so like we used to listen to scanners back in the day.
We used to listen to our scanners back in the day. they usually don't have, if there's a live webcast of a show, I'll have it on. Not so much with the South by Southwest for us, but definitely with what was the one I was just thinking of, the demo.
Oh yeah,
in the desert, and a lot of those types of shows. I didn't do it for TechCrunch because I was at TechCrunch, but you know, if I've got other reporters listening to you know, following that stuff, I make sure that they are either there physically or there virtually through that sort of mode. So yeah, I mean, if a live event has a webcast going along with it, then I'm usually there as well. But it's like listening to a police scanner, because then you can double back on something. Let's say, for example, the last one was we had a reporter who was at South by listening in on South, was it Southwest West? I'm trying to think. No, it was the. The Sun Micro did an announcement of that they were entering the cloud space. They had they now have a cloud strategy, and I had a reporter who's in Washington D.C., but the event was happening in New York City. We actually had one of my editors, or actually my editor in chief was there physically, but my reporter was dialed in virtually, and so between the two of them, they came back with a whole bunch of feedback on what really happened and what they heard. And one guy said, "Oh, did you hear this?" And yes, I did, and that kind of thing. So it's like a little stopgap measure too.
All right.
I'm going to stop you. You're
stopping
me. No, it's all about me today.
Yeah. Well, anyway. I want to do a quick word association for the questions that I didn't get to. So I'm just going to blurt out a word or a phrase.
Okay.
And I need you just to quickly give me an answer.
Go for it.
So how many emails in your inbox?
1,500.
Influence. Is it really word of mouth?
My biggest influence is my wife and my kids, so yes.
Okay. We've never really had a chance to talk about social networking, but obviously, you know, we're B2B social networking experts, so B2B social networking.
B2B is overused phrase. Social networking is going to become an overused phrase. I like to think of what we're doing now is just business conversation. So, you know, tribes. I'll say that.
Tribes. You got the SCNNR or whatever it is survey this week, I can tell. What's changed for you at work the most? Last year.
My responsibility, it increased tremendously. We did, a year and a half ago, we did a reorganization, and then it morphed into CMP was the company that was running Information Week, and that changed to TechWeb. And I think the current structure is the winner, and it's going to go forward. And so for me, you know, just stepping into these shoes for the last 8 months now, but I mean, I've been with the company for like two, but the last 8 months I've had this kind of responsibility level, and I'm expecting it to increase. So
fantastic.
More work.
well, work is good in this climate. One last question. Future of journalism.
Alive.
Oh, and
oh,
I'm
you want one word? Oh, you want one more or less?
That's fine. And okay. Then I have one more that I just realized I wanted to add. Web 3.0.
Semantic web.
Semantic web?
Yeah, that's the designation. Web 2.0, you know, is Tim O'Reilly's baby. We adopted it. That's why we co-produced the show with O'Reilly Media. But
uh-huh.
3.0, in a nutshell, is the semantic web. So that's kind of like that push kind of suggestion that I was telling you about. Now, will it become a buzzword?
We have I'm sorry, Michael. We only have a few more seconds. I'm going to call you after the show.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you for tuning in to Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, our guest is Kevin Spear, who's with Bunchball, which is a company that takes community to a whole new level. That's 1 week from today at 8 a.m. Pacific time. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and Eastwick in general at blogs.eastwick.com, and have a great weekend. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.